In our study of history and geography of the Bible, we have tried to identify the importance of events with places and look at them on the map and see the relevance of that. We're studying this morning history and geography of the Bible. For those of you who just came in, we're studying in 1 Samuel chapter 18 and the chapters following during the reign of King Saul. We've noted that Moses, when he brought the children of Israel up out of the land of Egypt, told them that if you worship and serve idols, what's going to happen to you? You'll lose the land. You'll be destroyed. You'll be taken off of the land. And we read about that where? Very quickly, this is a review. Deuteronomy 4, Deuteronomy 8, 28 through 30, when Joshua brought them into the land. We see that the land was conquered as such. They did not drive out all of the inhabitants. They did not refuse to make covenants with some of the people. So consequently, some of the people did continue to live in the land, but the land was delivered unto them. And Joshua chapter 11. And when we come to Joshua chapter 21, beginning in verse 43, what does Joshua tell them? Joshua chapter 21, verse 43. Again, this familiar territory. Review. God gave you the land, all the land which He promised to give unto the fathers. You possessed the land and you dwelt in it. All right? And then He reminds them in Joshua chapter 23. Yes. It has been fulfilled. However, Joshua chapter 23, not one thing has failed, beginning in verse 14, and then the warning in verse 16. What is it? Joshua chapter 23, verse 16. All right, very simple warning. Now, all of these warnings were indeed to be fulfilled when Moses gave them the warning. This was before they ever came into the land, before Joshua led them into the land, before they conquered it. And now Joshua has affirmed that everything has been fulfilled, and if you worship idols, here's what will surely happen. Go ahead. It is a promise. When it happens, this is what's going to be with you. Now, the book of Judges. Judges chapter 2. Joshua and all that generation died. Verse 10, what happens? They forget. And what is the book of Judges about? Remember the circle, Randy? All right, oppression. Yes. All right, how many judges? 13 judges, counting Abimelech. We've got, actually, I believe counting Abimelech, we've got 15 judges. Counting Abimelech. Now, why did I say counting Abimelech? What made Abimelech different from the others? This is off the subject. All right, he was a self-appointed king, declared himself to be king. Of course, we've talked about that. But how long did this period of the judges last? About 300 plus years that they went around this cycle of being faithful to God, then idolatry, and then they were oppressed, and then they would cry to God, and God would send them a deliverer or a judge who would deliver them from the hand of their enemies, and they would remain faithful for a while. Now, when you consider the number of judges and the number of years, you see that they involved themselves in the practice of idolatry for a long time. Now, during the days of Moses as he brought them up out of the land of Egypt. He told them, the day will come when you will ask for a king. You remember the passage? Deuteronomy chapter 17. Deuteronomy chapter 17. You will ask for a king. And when you ask for a king, that's not an if either. That's a when you ask for a king, you're not to appoint just anybody. And the king that you do appoint, he is not to multiply wives to himself. He's not to return to Egypt. He's not to make alliances with these others. And he is to write down the law so that it be read, so that he does not worship idols. Now, what happened in the days of Samuel? Okay, this a little bit later, but yes, that does come. That's what will happen when you ask for a king. Now, in 1 Samuel chapter 8, what did they do? Remember, Samuel is the last of the judges. He's old, his sons are not faithful to the Lord, and they came to him, and what did they request? A king, just like Moses said. Now, time frame. When we are studying these events of history and geography of the Bible, one of the things that makes it impressive, at least to me, is how much time passes between the time that this is said and it is fulfilled. When we look over here at Deuteronomy chapter 17, remember, who said that? Moses did. This is before they ever came into the promised land, so it's before the days of the conquering that we read about in the book of Joshua. And we also note that it's during the days of the last of the judges that they asked for a king, and the period of the judges lasted for how long? 300 plus years. So from the time that Moses said that till the time that it was fulfilled when they asked for a king was approximately how long? You'd be safe to say between 300 and 400 years. Did time change anything? It didn't. They did the very thing that Moses said that they would do, and so they asked for a king. Saul is made their first king. How was Saul's presentation as king in the beginning? Very humble. Very, very humble. Didn't consider himself worthy to even be considered. He said, I am a Benjamite, that's the smallest tribe of all of Israel, and I am the least in my father's house. How do you talk to me about being king? And then when the Ammonites began to threaten the Israelites, King Saul was found among, let me get on the right page. No. The Ammonites are later. When Saul was following the oxen, was that the Ammonites? In chapter 7. Yes, the Ammonites. And he was following the oxen. That's right. I like to be right even if I'm not sure. Chapter 11. He was following the oxen in the field when the Ammonites said, we'll make peace with you if you'll poke out your right eye. And they said, we'll have to think about that. And when they told King Saul, he was furious. And what did he do? That's chapter 11. That's right. Well, that would put you out of the farming business, wouldn't it? It would. And so he formulated an army, a rather large army, and fought against the Ammonites and delivered the people from the hand of the Ammonites, chapter 11. Brings us now to chapter 13. We've got a different enemy, not the Ammonites, but the Philistines. And the Philistines' army is quite substantial. It's described in verse 5 of chapter 13 as 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen. How many people does Saul have in his army? Now he's established a standing army. 3,000. And now he's fighting against those of 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen. You recall that Saul was told by Samuel, "You wait in Gilgal, and I'll come and offer an offering, and we'll beseech the Lord to see what you're to do." And what did Saul do? When he came to Gilgal, he waited how long? All right, he didn't really wait till the last moment. He didn't give Samuel the necessary time to be there. He thought he had, but he hadn't. And when Samuel came immediately on the heels of Saul having offered the offering, what did Samuel tell him? "You have done foolishly." Why was it so foolish? Isn't he beseeching the Lord? Isn't he offering a sacrifice? Who's Saul to offer a sacrifice? Well, he's not a priest. Now, there's a big difference. You see, we've identified that Samuel was of the priestly lineage going back to the Kohathites of the descent of Aaron. And so, consequently, Samuel was authorized to offer a sacrifice, and Saul didn't wait. He presumed to go beyond what God had said through Samuel. Now, that brings us then to the 15th chapter. Well, I want to comment just briefly on the 14th chapter. We note that Jonathan and his armor bearer, two people, agree between them that they're going to attack the garrison of the Philistines. Were they successful? Yes, on their first attack, they killed 20 of the Philistines. That got the attention of the Philistines, and that got the attention of Saul's remaining army that's now dwindled down to only 600 men. The rest of them, in fear, have fled away or deserted. And so Saul's small army now joins Jonathan and his armor bearer to fight against the Philistines. And Saul makes a ridiculous proposal. When he begins to see that his small army is being successful, what does he require of his army? Don't eat until they're completely defeated. Well, what happens to his army? Yes, sir. Well, on the surface, it certainly appears that way. But the problem is, to come to that conclusion, we must demand that Samuel didn't do what he said that he would do, and therefore his rebuke of Saul would be unjust. No, he shouldn't have. He surely shouldn't have. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it seems that that is a possibility, I suppose. It seems that as Saul recognized Samuel coming, or Samuel came, on the heels of his offering the sacrifice. Look, if you will, at verse 10. It says, "And it came to pass, as soon as he had made an end of offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him, and that he might salute him. And Samuel said, What hast thou done? And Saul said, Because, verse 11, I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that thou camest not within the days appointed, and that the Philistines assembled themselves together at Michmash. Therefore said I, Now will the Philistines come down unto me to Gilgal, and I have not entreated the favor of Jehovah. I forced myself, therefore, and offered the burnt offering. And Samuel said, Thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the commandment of Jehovah." And you're right. Regardless of whether Samuel had come at the appointed time or not, Saul is not the one to offer the sacrifice. But be that as it may, it seems that there's either an excuse offered by Saul or a misunderstanding offered by Saul. I'm not so certain that he perhaps offered the sacrifice just prior to Samuel's planned arrival. But be that as it may. Randy? Yeah, that's not given. But I'll see you next Monday. Yeah. 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 Point is, he's acted presumptuously. He didn't do what Samuel told him to do. And so consequently, there is the rejection of Saul's kingdom being extended to his son and so forth. Now, I don't know if that's satisfactory or not, but it's something to think about. But when we consider that Jonathan has led the charge in chapter 14, and then in chapter 15, Saul's messed up again. I want you to notice Saul's explanation in chapter 15, very similar fashion to chapter 13. What was it God told Saul to do in chapter 15? And he didn't do it. But how did he explain it? All right. What I want you to see in chapter 15, yes, he excuses his behavior on behalf of the people, but look at chapter 15 beginning at verse 13. Verse 13. And Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said unto him, "Blessed be thou, Jehovah, I have performed the commandment of Jehovah." And here and again we see a bold affirmation, "I did what God said." Did he? Look, if you will, again at verse 20. And Saul said to Samuel, "Yea, I have obeyed the voice of Jehovah." Had he? Well, my question is, do you see Saul's credibility eroding? His statements, "I've done this, I did what you said to do," they're not true. He didn't do what he was told to do. And that's what Samuel rebukes him for. You didn't do what God told you to do. Now, question. The consequence from chapter 13, the consequence from chapter 15, what were they? Consequences. The kingdom is taken away. Now, what did Samuel tell Saul as to why? Yes, say that again. God wants a man after his own heart. There's somebody, Saul, that's better than you. Now, let me ask you a question. When you clearly read, this is what the text says, this is what I need to do, and you know you didn't do that. Are we inclined to just make an excuse? To argue, to begin to make defense, or as we used to say in Kentucky, just shell down the corn and say, "I messed up." What do we do? What do you do? Well, look at the text. In verse 23 of chapter 15, Samuel said, "For rebellion is as sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as idolatry and teraphim. Because thou hast rejected the word of Jehovah, he also hath rejected thee from being king." In verse 26, "Thou hast rejected the word of God," or the word of Jehovah, "and Jehovah hath rejected thee from being king over Israel." I'm reading from the 1901 American Standard Translation, for those of you who may not know that. In verse 35, it says, "And Samuel came no more to see Saul unto the day of his death, for Samuel mourned for Saul, and Jehovah repented that he had made Saul king over Israel." Now, my question to you is, what's happened to Saul? He's the first king of Israel. He started out very humble. His heart seems to be good. But what's happened to him now? In what way? Well, what sometimes causes us to do that? Pride. Pride gets in the way. And that really creates a real big problem. We noted that in chapter 18 and following that David begins to rise in prominence. In chapter 17, there's again the threat of the Philistines, and they send out Goliath. And Goliath makes fun of them. For how long? 40 days. That'd be a bit humiliating. And then here comes David. And tell me the story quickly. What does David do? Randy? Yeah. Yeah, he does. He does do that, and he does it in the name of the living God. Now, when we come to the 18th chapter, 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel, the 18th chapter. We read of the covenant that's made between David and Jonathan. They become very close friends. And as a result of the things that David is doing, what now has become his reputation? Well, all right. Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Well, that don't go over so well with Saul. The text tells us that it came to pass, verse 10 of chapter 18, that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul. And he prophesied in the midst of the house, and David played with his hand as he did day by day. And Saul had his spear in his hand, and Saul cast the spear, for he said, I will smite David even to the wall. We find that Saul makes at least three attempts to kill David. And this evil spirit, someone, I forgot, Reba, might have been you, somebody came to me and asked me about the evil spirit as it came from the Lord in verse 10 of chapter 18. And there, I believe there's about two or three references to that, that the evil spirit was sent from the Lord. The explanation that I would propose for that is simply this. We know in our Old Testament study that the text tells us a number of times during the days of the plagues that Pharaoh hardened his heart. Also tells us that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. How did God harden Pharaoh's heart at the same time Pharaoh hardened his own heart? How do we reconcile those? Okay, all right. Let's add something to that. That's good. Go ahead. He didn't want to do it. He didn't want to do it. Now, let me ask you, what happens when you start down that path? And you're determined. You keep going. You keep going. You keep going. Does it get better? It only gets better when you back up, when you repent. It gets easier, yeah. Well, what's happening with Saul? God sent an evil spirit. What's happened to Saul? Yes. Okay. You think maybe he's getting a bad case of conscience? Well, perhaps so. Well, what we want to see is he's greatly troubled. And being greatly troubled, it's suggested that he send for someone to play music to provide some solace for him. And David is the one that is chosen to do that. And we know that at the beginning, did they not become good friends? Yes. Yes. If you look at chapter 16, verse 21, David came to Saul and stood before him, and he loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. And Saul sent to Jesse, saying, "Let David, I pray thee, stand before me, for he hath found favor in my sight." And it came to pass when an evil spirit from God, there it is again, was upon Saul, that David took the harp and played with his hand. So Saul was refreshed and was well, and the evil spirit departed from him. Now that's just interesting to me. But what we notice, Saul is deeply troubled. What's caused Saul to be deeply troubled? We say, well, God did that to him. Did God make him deeply troubled in some kind of a supernatural, beyond his control means? Well, he's changed in his disposition. He started very humble, submission. But now we see a spirit of rebellion and stubbornness, as Samuel called it. But the question remains, Randy. It is indeed. It is true. I do. Something wrong with Saul's heart. Now, who's responsible for that is my question. Is God responsible for that or is Saul? Saul's responsible for that. He's responsible. Yeah, and that's... Yes. David? Okay. Well, it does, but it's not to be. Now, regarding Goliath, the giant of the Philistines, and David, what was to be the reward of the one of the Israelite army that would kill the Philistine? All right, now that was the proposal of Goliath. If you can beat me, then we'll be your servants. If I beat you, you'll be our servants. But what did Saul offer to the man that would kill Goliath, whoever he be? All right, his daughter, great wealth and freedom. David killed Goliath. Did he get Saul's daughter? Well, not that one. All right, he didn't get that one. Saul did not make good on that promise. Later we see that Saul's daughter, Michal, loved David. Saul thinks that's a very good idea. Why? All right, she'll distract David and be a snare to him. And so this is a good thing, Saul thinks. It'll cause David to be killed. Now, when we see the arrangement of the dowry to be paid, Saul requires a dowry. What was the price? 100 foreskins. All right, that's going to be challenging, isn't it? To go out here and kill 100 Philistines. So David goes out and kills 200 Philistines. He more than pays the dowry. And again, we see that the reason for this dowry, as requested by Saul, was in hopes that David would be killed by the Philistines. And though Saul at first admires David, it doesn't last. It's his desire that David be killed. Now, we've noted a little bit in our last study that the arrangement between David and Jonathan, they've become the very best of friends. And Jonathan's idea is that he'll work to try to make sure David is safe. And when he finds out about his father's intent to kill David, he raises the question, why? Why kill David? And what does Saul then do to Jonathan? Throws a spear at him, tries to kill him, his own son. Well, that ought to get our attention just a little bit. And then we know that David's life is certainly in jeopardy, and Jonathan makes arrangements with David that he might flee. Yes. Yes, he wanted to kill his own son. Yeah, that's true. That's true. We see lots of problems with Saul and his attitude. Michal helped David to escape. Of course, that was a disappointment to Saul. But I want to spend just a little bit of time with the flight of David for his own safety as he flees from Saul. Now, we talked briefly about the emotional parting between Jonathan and David. They loved each other, the very best of friends. And Jonathan made arrangements to go and practice with his bow. And if I say to my lad, go farther, then David, you go farther, you run. It's the plan or plot of my father Saul to kill you, and that was the plan. Of course, and we read about that in chapter 20, beginning in verse 35. Now look at the map, if you will, just a bit. We see that David escapes to Ramah to see Samuel. And Saul sends messengers three times. And what happens with the messengers when they come to Ramah? All three times. They prophesy. Saul goes. And what does Saul do? Saul prophesies. Wouldn't you think that would get your attention? Say, wait just a minute, maybe I'm playing the wrong part just here. But no, not at all. He continues his pursuit of David. And where then does David flee? All right, well, he first flees to Nob in chapter 21 in verse 1. And then he flees to the Philistines. We've talked about going to Nob and how that there he's given food. And we discussed that, and we talked about the sword of Goliath was given to him, and then he went to Gath to the Philistines. You'll notice in chapter 21 and verse 10, it tells us that David arose and fled that day for fear of Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. And keep in mind, if you will, that it has been heard among the Philistines that Saul has slain his thousands in verse 11, and David his 10,000s. Well, we note that among the Philistines, Among the Philistines, David might at first think that he would have safety there. But when the Philistines know of the reputation of David, is David's life really secure with them? He killed their champion. That's right. He killed Goliath. But he's not safe with them either, at least at this point. And so how does he escape from the Philistines? Chapter 21, latter part of the chapter. He pretends to be crazy. And Achish, the king of the Philistines, or the king of the city of Gath, we learn that he raises the question, do you think I don't have enough madmen? And so David leaves, and then he comes to the cave of Adullam. And that brings us to chapter 22, beginning in verse 1. Again, I want to call your attention to where these places are and proximity to each other. David flees from the land of the Philistines to the cave of Adullam. And what happens there? You'll note in verse 2, what begins to happen? He's gaining a following. But look at the people that are following David. Everyone that is in distress, everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented gathered themselves unto him, and he became captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men. Jenny, how would you characterize the reputation of David's army? Well, that's a nice word. Well, that's a good word too. I was thinking more along the lines of hoodlums, but that's kind of what they are, and they band together with David in Adullam. But notice, if you will, in verse 3, David went thence to Mizpah of Moab, and he said unto the king of Moab, let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you till I know what God will do for me. What does David do with his parents? Brings them over here to Moab. Now, somebody remind me, what's the relationship between the Moabites and the Israelites? They're cousins. Tell me how. Through Lot by his daughters. That's right. The incestuous relationship of Lot and his daughters as they got him drunk and conceived children by him. So now he's in Mizpah of Moab. Saul pursues David further. We notice that David comes over to Hereth in the land of Judah. And he hides there in the forest of Hereth. Chapter 22 in verse 5. When Saul heard that he was there, what does he do? Somebody mentioned Doeg. Who wanted to talk about Doeg? Ah, Doeg. Let's talk about Doeg. Look, if you will, at verse 6. It says in chapter 22, verse 6, and Saul heard that David was discovered, and the men that were with him. Now Saul was sitting in Gibeah under a tamarisk, the tamarisk tree in Ramah with his spear in his hand, and his servants were standing about him. And Saul said unto his servants that stood about him, hear now, ye Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds, that all of you have conspired against me? And there is none that discloseth to me when my son maketh a league with me, the son of Jesse. And there is none of you that is sorry for me or discloseth unto me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, who stood by the servants of Saul, and said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of Jehovah for him, and gave him victuals, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Now, tell me about Doeg. Well, first of all, tell me, what kind of argument is this that Saul is making to his people? You've all turned against me. Poor me. You all know about where David is. You know what he's doing, and nobody will come and tell me. And Doeg says, I'll tell you. I've heard he's down here. He was. Ahimelech. And so the king sent to call Ahimelech, the priest, the son of Ahitub, and to inquire, basically saying, is that true? Is that what you did? And how does Ahimelech answer? Verse 14. Yeah, verse 14. Then Ahimelech answered the king and said, "And who among all thy servants is so faithful as David? Who is the king's son-in-law, and is taken into thy counsel, and is honorable in thy house? Have I today begun to inquire of Jehovah for him? Far be it far rather from me, let not the king impute anything unto his servant, nor to all the house of my father, for thy servant knoweth nothing of all this, less or more." Now, Ahimelech has answered very kindly to Saul, "You don't have a greater servant than David. There's not anybody more faithful to you than David is. And so have I begun to inquire today of God for him?" Well, you see, the point being, you need to realize who David is. You need to understand who I am. But rather than do that, what does Saul do? Orders that he be killed. Well, who's willing to step to the plate and kill the priest? Doeg likes that job. Yeah, Doeg will do it. Nobody else will. And why? They're priests. But Doeg says, or Doeg, let me find it. The king said to Doeg in verse 18, "Turn thou and fall upon the priest." And Doeg the Edomite turned and fell upon the priest. And he slew on that day 85 persons that did wear the linen ephod. 85 priests he killed. Well, did that work out real good? Well, look at verse 20. "And one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar told David that Saul had slain Jehovah's priest. And David said unto Abiathar, 'I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of thy father's house. Abide thou here with me, or abide thy with me, fear not, for he that seeketh my life seeketh thy life, for with me thou shalt be in safeguard.'" Well, David moves, goes to another place, fleeing from Saul. Where does he go? Okay, Juan? Okay. That's an interesting thought, yeah. Yeah, that. It's not a good thing either, is it? Not a good thing. Other questions or comments while we're here? Randy? Uh-huh. They're not willing to do that. Would stand in opposition to the king. That's an interesting thought, and that's right. All right. Well, David flees. He finds out that the Philistines are on the warpath again, and they're attacking those of Keilah, and he responds, chapter 23, verse 1. He's doing essentially what Saul ought to be doing. He's defending the people of God against the attacks of the Philistines. And what's Saul doing? He's trying to kill David. Now, in verse 2 of chapter 23, David inquired of Jehovah, saying, "Shall I go and smite these Philistines?" And Jehovah said unto David, "Go and smite the Philistines and save Keilah." And David's men said unto him, "Behold, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more then if we go to Keilah against the armies of the Philistines?" And David inquired of Jehovah yet again. And what did God tell him to do? Go. And what did David do? He went. Yes. In verse 10. "Then said David, O Jehovah, the God of Israel, thy servant has surely heard that Saul seeketh to come to Keilah to destroy the city for my sake. Will the men of Keilah deliver me up into his hand? Will Saul come down as thy servant hath heard? O Jehovah, the God of Israel, I beseech thee, tell thy servant. Now David's gone over and defended the city of Keilah against the attack of the Philistines, and his concern is this a good place for me and my men to hide, or will they betray me? And what does God say? They'll betray you. Yeah, they'll deliver you into the hand of Saul. So what does David do? He flees again, and where does he go? The wilderness of Ziph. And note where that is on our map. It's interesting to me to note that these places that David goes are not really all that far apart, necessarily, but he does flee, and he goes to the wilderness of Ziph. You see that in chapter 23 in verse 14. Jonathan learns where he is, and he comes and assures him that the difficulty that's going on with his father Saul is not changing his feelings about David at all. In verse 17, he said unto him, "Fear not, for the hand of Saul, my father, shall not find thee, and thou shalt be king over Israel, and I shall be next unto thee, and that also Saul, my father, knoweth." And they too made a covenant before Jehovah, and David abode in the wood, and Jonathan went to his house. The Ziphites then came to Saul. And what do they do? They turn him in. So now King Saul knows where David is. He's among those in Ziph. And so it becomes necessary for David to flee once again to the wilderness of Maon in Araba. And therein again he is pursued. Now, the Araba, somebody tell me about this region. What's rather distinctive about the Araba? Desert. Very desert. Very low, low elevation. Remember the Dead Sea, the surface of the Dead Sea is about what elevation? About 1,300 feet below sea level. And then, of course, we've got several feet down. I have forgotten, is it 1,000 or 2,000 feet, the depth of the Dead Sea? You can look that up for me, Richard. I want to think 2,000. Okay. Another 1,300 feet. Okay, so we've got a very low area here coming up from the Dead Sea, coming out into this barren wilderness area. That's the second bell. Okay, we'll start with chapter 23 next time. Be sure you note that and be prepared to talk about that some more as David continues to flee from King Saul. Read on through, if you would please, through the end, at least, of 1 Samuel.